My name is Camilla, and I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would be also helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Kareth and Giroux, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers in any case. We hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Melanie will read the preamble.
Hi, I'm Melanie, and I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not aligned with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Janine, I'm sorry. Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Janine will read the steps.
Hi, I'm Jeannie, alcoholic. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Charlie will read the traditions.
Hi, my name is Charlie. I'm an alcoholic. And these are the 12 traditions. 1, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants, did they do not govern. 3, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Howard.
Hi, I'm Howard. I'm an alcoholic. Let's see. My sober date is September 16th, 2002. So I just celebrated 8 years on Thursday. My sponsor is Jeff Kay, and my wonderful home group is the Atlantic Group. And I do love this group. You know, right before I, you know, spoke tonight and when I got here, I just had a couple of conversations with friends, some of you. Somebody asked me to pray before the meeting. I spoke to a sober brother before, and we shared about our fears and our craziness together. I mean, you know, so much of, and that's what I love about this group, is it gave me a program, and it gives me direction and the solution. And, you know, I didn't have that before I came here and before I surely got sober. So here we go, 10 minutes. What it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I grew up in Brooklyn, a nice Jewish baby. And I say that because the nice Jewish baby turned into not so nice of a Jewish boy. But to tell you a little bit about now, that not so nice Jewish boy, thanks to this program, is a nice Jewish man. So, you know, I had this disease and alcoholism from my first, you know, recollection. I knew from 6 years old, you know, that something wasn't right. You know, I wasn't loved, I wasn't cared for, I wasn't enough, you were better than me, and I just had that big hole and that big void. And that's, you know, I'm not big on a drunkalogue, but that was how I lived my life. I mean, I lived my life doing everything I could to just numb the feelings of that big hole. I drank, I drugged, I, you know, overworked, I overshopped, I overdid everything. And that's how I lived my life. I thought I was managing. I really thought I was managing, you know, and without going into details, you know, like I told you, that nice Jewish baby turned into a not so nice of a Jewish boy. And I wound up doing things that I wasn't proud of. You know, I became a liar and a thief. And, you know, it just became all about what I could do to feel better at any cost. And, you know, speeding up to when I got sober, you know, like I said, I always thought I managed. You know, I thought my life was fine. I wasn't a daily drinker. I wasn't a daily user. And I didn't have a problem. I knew how to put it on the shelf, and my life was functioning. You know, I had a job. I made money. I didn't make money. I had clothes. I didn't have clothes. I just, you know, I thought I managed. I didn't have a true problem. And I forgot how old I was. There was this one substance that really just kicked my butt, and I couldn't manage anymore, and it took over, and I realized I had a problem. And after a lot of kicking and screaming, I went into rehab, and rehab was a great experience. And except I thought they were nuts when they told me that alcohol was a drug. Like, you're crazy. You know, I don't have a problem with alcohol. So I think I need to speed this up. I got sober. I came into AA, and I was going to do my program the same way I lived my life, my way. You know, I'll take your direct. I really didn't take much directions at all. People gave me phone numbers. I threw them out. No, actually, before the first relapse, at 90 days, people would ask me to give me their phone number, and I said, no, thank you. That's how sick I was. And then I had a relapse, and I cried for a week, and I took phone numbers, but after the meeting, I threw them out. Progress, not perfection. And I had another relapse after 6 months. And that relapse could have got me in a lot of trouble with the law. And it didn't. And I remember crying to my sponsor then, thanks. I don't know if this is going to work for me. I just might have a bigger problem. And he said, let's talk about how it works. And he said, rarely have we seen a person fail. Sorry. Half measures availed us nothing. And we had to let go of old ideals. That's how it works. If you want to continue doing it your way, okay. I'll still sponsor you, but, you know, let's see what happens. And I had that moment of clarity that if I don't do this program as it's outlined, then it's a crapshoot, and let's see what happens, you know. And I knew it wasn't going to be good. And that was the beginning of, you know, one day at a time. And I had 4 years, and my life got better, and I was doing some work, and I sponsored somebody for about 24 hours, and yeah, my life got good. But I was not happy, and I was not content and not fulfilled, and I just really wasn't happy. And then I found you, and I came here 4 years ago, September. And my life has changed. More. I got, like I talked about, the clear direction and the friendship and the kindness and the tough love, you know, because I'm a baby. You know, I want to be a big baby until the day I die. And my sponsor said, there's no adult diapers yet for you. So he told me early on, he says, you're too young for adult diapers. Get over it. And that's the kind of sponsorship that I need, because I need to grow up. I never grew up. And, you know, I'm growing up slowly. For me, my path and my recovery is slow. So where I am now, you know, like I said, I just celebrated 8 years, and it's a miracle. It really is. And my life has changed yet more since the 4 years I walked in. But lately, I got very big, and my God got very small. And the reason why I'm a little choked up about remembering my sponsor then telling me how it works is because I recalled that just the other day when my current sponsor drilled into my head that, you know, your life needs to be about two things, you know, God and service. And you do a pretty crappy job at both, so let's get going. And I was thrown back into how it works, you know. And also our preamble, you know. My primary purpose is to stay sober and help another alcoholic achieve sobriety. My primary purpose is not to make money, even though I like to make money. And my primary purpose is not to do all these things. My primary purpose is to stay sober and to help another alcoholic achieve sobriety. And when I do that, I have had those times when I felt at peace and okay with myself and happy, and you know, the promises of being happy and joyous and free and not regretting the past and fear of financial insecurity will leave us. I've had nice periods of time of that. And I have it, and then I forget that it's a daily job. That's what I do. I get very complacent very quickly. And, you know, I realize that today. I don't beat myself up for it. It doesn't feel great. But that's, you know, I'm sober, and I get to do the best I can today. You know, if I stop and I write a gratitude list and I think about how I've changed and the person who I told you how I walked in here years ago, arrogant, doing it on my own, you know, it's a miracle. And, you know, thanks AG and thanks AA.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Kathleen.
Thanks. Thanks, Phil. My name is Kathleen. I'm an alcoholic. So, first, my sobriety date is May 11th of 2001. My sponsor is Ava, and I'm really grateful to be a part of this as my home group. And I'm really grateful to be here. I was brought to this group by many women who attend this meeting, and I'm so glad to have been introduced to it because I think I found here in a lot of ways what I was looking for, and I didn't know I was looking for it at the time, but I got to get a service commitment here, and much like Howard's experience before the meeting tonight, I saw a sponsee sister. I, you know, got to say a prayer with some close friends, and now I'm up here, and I'm just really glad to get to share my experience, strength, and hope. So, what happened? I got sober pretty young. My experience with alcohol started at 15, and it was a quick run. I mean, I had about 4 years. The first thing that happened is the first time I really got drunk, I blacked out, and I just loved it. I was fun, people took pictures, there was a lot of talk, and it was very jovial, and like I wanted to do it again. So by the time I was 17, though, I had had my second like pretty severe experience with alcohol, and that was that landed me on the steps of my best friend's house, bleeding, and kind of unconscious and in an ambulance. And like, I guess that's graphic, but the truth is like, I need to remember that today, that that's where alcohol takes me. It's like, it doesn't stay jovial and it's not pretty. And it's like my alcoholism is severe as, I mean, and like it says in How It Works, like it's cunning, baffling, and powerful. And I remember that today, one day at a time, because you know, I was told that night by a nurse in the hospital that I was an alcoholic, and I was 17, and the only idea of an alcoholic that I had in my mind was like a picture that I didn't think was myself. So I kind of refused to accept it. And like it says, you know, like no one can tell us we're an alcoholic. We have to know it for ourselves. So I went and did more research, and then by the time I was 19, I was pretty much at what I, you know, I was at my bottom. I was willing to come in here and accept help. I had been exposed to AA at 17, but didn't stay sober, because obviously, I mean, I wasn't, I guess, ready or beaten into a state of willingness, but by the time I was 19, certainly I was. I certainly couldn't have gotten up here that day and, like, shared my experience with you guys. I was pretty quiet and introverted, and my life was unmanageable. I like was waking up in the morning and not showering, and my room was full of dirty clothes. Like just like the whole thing. Like I have these photographs that I still keep today of like my room, and just remembering exactly what that picture looked like. And it's good for me to have those today again, because it's like when I get up here and share at a meeting, or when I meet with a sponsee, or whatever experiences I have in recovery, they remind me that like I'm still an alcoholic, and that's not going to change. So, you know, I came into AA through treatment. Treatment didn't keep me sober. I relapsed in treatment with a lot of other sick people, and I like met women in AA though, because we had this requirement to go to meetings. So I got their phone numbers and I kept them. And when I got out, they were very young also. So when I got out, I got this sponsor, and she was 18 and I was 19, and we started reading the book. And we read more about alcoholism, which was really helpful to me, because it talks about, for me at least, like, I'm probably going to misquote it, but she made me substitute all these pronouns in that passage, and I still do that with sponsees today. It's like, instead of it being we, it's also I, and I can kind of like fully concede to my innermost self that I'm an alcoholic. And until I was ready to do that, I didn't stay sober. So I guess, you know, my experience in sobriety has been, I feel like I'm going really fast, but it hasn't even been 5 minutes yet. So, but my experience in sobriety has been pretty significant. I mean, I've gotten to go back to school. I've gotten to work with other women in recovery. I've made a lot of choices, sometimes good ones, sometimes bad ones, but like learned through that experience. I feel like a big part of sobriety has been obviously working the steps, but also kind of like continuing to work them and knowing that like they're not something I just do once and then I'm like cured. Okay, 5 minutes. I guess, you know, some of the things that have been painful in sobriety is kind of acting out in those defects that kind of rear their ugly head. And when I do that, it's not that it brings me back to drinking. It could, and I remember that today, but it's like I have to kind of get honest with the sponsor still and like recognize those things and like look at them for what they really are and try and turn them over and like trust that a higher power will hopefully take care of them, because I can't do it on my own. It's like, that's what it still comes down to, is like, I need help, and it's like, I'm willing today still to kind of seek out that help in these rooms. I had a strange experience that happened about 2 years ago now. A sponsor that I'd had for most of my sobriety relapsed, and I share that experience because for me, that was when my sobriety really, it was kind of black and white again. It was kind of like, either I'm going to stay sober or I'm not. And I had to like go back to AA and say like, you know, ask for help and find a new sponsor. And it was really an uncomfortable time, because she had been a pretty significant part of my life. But, okay, thanks. It made me remember that like people say in the rooms, like, my higher power keeps me sober today, not only my sponsor, and I have to kind of like seek out that relationship as well. So I guess I'm actually moving, so I'm glad I get to speak here today, because I'm moving this weekend, and it's been a tough decision, but I know now that it's the right one. I think one of my main things is my indecisiveness at times in sobriety that causes me some discomfort, and trying to just sit still in that discomfort can be awkward. But, you know, if I just try to look for the assistance of my friends and remember that, like, it's going to be okay, I usually get through it. I think just in sobriety in general, it can be hard to trust myself again and, like, learn how to make healthy decisions today and, like, know that that's the right thing. So it's a process. It's one day at a time. And what else? I guess, I don't know. I mean, wherever I go, AA is there, and I remember that today. It's like I can always get a service commitment, and I can always reach out and go to meetings. I got sober. I'm going back to Chicago, which is where I originally got sober, and there are many women that I still know there who have sobriety, and there's a group similar to the Atlanta group that's there too, which is really nice. So I think that's all I have to share. I don't know how much time I have left, so... I'm really glad I got to be here tonight, and thanks again.
Our main speaker tonight is Alan. Good evening, everybody. My name is Alan. I'm an alcoholic. I can't begin to tell you how pleased and proud I am to be asked to speak at this group. I've been here many times, and... It's kind of a home away from home for me for many different reasons. I have a lot of friends here tonight. I know you've all said a prayer for me. I'm a little nervous. I almost fell asleep during the infomercials. I was waiting for the AG elliptical race or something, but I'm 59 years old. I grew up in Little Neck, Queens. I'm Jewish. Am I alone here? I don't think so. Howard and the other resident people of my faith have come to disprove the notion that Jews don't drink. And, you know, my parents grew up in Brooklyn. They got married after World War II. They moved out to something that would be called the New Suburbia. It was red brick garden apartments on the newly built Long Island Expressway. I grew up with a baby brother named Jeff, and it was a different time in society. It was the late 1950s, the early 1960s, and it was really a different time, and I really loved it. And how I like to cite what growing up was like in that innocent kind of time was we used to love to watch black and white TV with rabbit ears, and we turned it manually. And, you know, all the shows that all these young kids are watching on TV land, that was our first run shows. And for people like Jeff and I, as little kids watching this thing, it wasn't the Leave It to Beaver or the Father Knows Best or, you know, with Little Rascals was our favorites. What we loved the most, Cowboys and Indians. Now, it wasn't the Goody Two-Shoes Cowboys and Indians. It wasn't the Roy Rogers, Dale Evans, or the wagon train stories where you were actually going to, family was going to take their kids from here to there to have a new life. What I love the most, a guy comes flying into Dodge City at 12 o'clock high, flies off the horse, takes the reins, flips him around the hitching post, goes into a bar and asks for a whole bottle and a shot glass, pours himself a couple, throws two back, shakes his head. I have no idea what that is. All I can tell you is that two shows later, I'm prodding the three-year-old. My mother, who likes to let us think it's cute to play make-believe, has me dressed up in, you know, a pair of six guns, Beretta bullets, chaps, vest, cowboy hat, Davy Crockett hat for the off day, and we were rocking and rolling to the sweet sounds of Drunken Cowboy before we ever knew what was going on. And my mother, a young parent, like most young parents, mother trying to do the right thing by her sons, takes us into the bathroom to show us the hygienic procedure of how to brush our teeth. In those days, you had to go to the dentist, get a completion note. You were really intense about how white. I don't know any of that. Future alcoholic perception. I get into the bathroom, I could care less about any of those things. All I see is a Dixie cup dispenser. And all I want to do is pull one down, pour my own, throw two back, and play make-believe. My mother told me 50 years later I'd walk around Little Neck playing Drunken Cowboy, singing Davy Crockett. And that's what I was like. You know, by the time I'm 7, my mother announces to the family she thinks she invented PMS. My father develops, oh, you identify? My father got this vein that started popping in his head like a garden hose, and the next thing I know, they're getting divorced. Now, this is, you know, 1958. There was no such thing as divorce in New York. It was illegal. The church forbade it. And so my father moved away. If you're on the verge of a divorce, I'll let you know you'll be leaving the wife the family car. And that's what it was like. So we lived in the boroughs, and my father took three buses for the first visitation. And here's the perception of young future alcohol. I'm standing at the living room window. My brother's standing next to me. My mother's standing next to him. She's got the PMS flaring. Two blocks away, my father turns. I could see the vein popping in his head. And my brother and I understood restless, irritable, and discontent right from the get-go. And, you know, I've heard it described in a million ways when we're young, what we feel different than, that hole in the soul, or, you know, pebble in the shoe feeling. And I got out of that real quick playing ball. I love sports. I played baseball all day long. I loved the Yankees. And by the time I'm 12, my mother, who's now negotiating on with her children on how we actually want to be raised, is trying to coerce me into doing, you know, what we would call the next right thing. So she's telling me I live in my Little League uniform, and that would be okay if I would succumb to going for bar mitzvah lessons. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I'm a baby boomer. I grew up in that time of year and in a solid Jewish neighborhood. And by the sheer volume, they had invented, you know, the catered affair when I was 13 years old. It wasn't before. And there was a place, a big catering hall, Leonard's a Great Neck, that they built right down the block from me. And by the sheer numbers, I'm scheduled to go there like every other week. So my mother buys me the little John Gotti bar mitzvah suit, tie. They had green gook in those days for the hair, which I think they reinvented as mousse or whatever, gel. And gives me a $25 bond to give to the kid, which was a lot of money in those days. And I go to my first bar mitzvah, future alcoholic. I don't see family celebration, rights of manhood, all this goodness. All I see is these big tables filled with whiskey sours and free Tarryton cigarettes. And without even blinking, okay, that drunken cowboy comes over, I walk right up, I throw two back, I shake my head, and boom! That thing that makes us bodily different from our fellows occurs. And Avery will tell you, I don't know what we were dancing, the bunny hop or whatever the hell it was. All I know is my mother's PMS history. My father's vein in his head, I could care less. All I know is, I'm going to, two or three bar mitzvahs down the road, I made a conscious decision. I was going to do as much of this as humanly possible. And even Howard will remember, you know, for the next 35 years, there were thousands of reasons to stop, and I never touched the brakes. And that's really my story. I mean, I went on and manifested all of the things that we do that get us here. My father told me at the earliest age that omission was the same as lying. I didn't understand that till I was 48 years old and I came into AA. And all that kind of stuff, I decided, I didn't want to tell my parents when I graduated high school that I was offered three college scholarships for sports because they would want me to go where they wouldn't have to pay. I wanted to go where you actually didn't have entrance exams or go to class and where we could party, how naked were we going to get, and you know who's going to be there and all that. I'm a Woodstock guy. I went from Woodstock out to Ohio University, this make-believe place where nobody would know that I'm really not going to school. And my father knew I was full of it. As a matter of fact, by the time I got into my last year, he held up the proverbial last check and said, this is it. You know, that what are you going to be when you're growing up kind of thing. And without even blinking, because I'm prepared for this, I'm thinking, you know, my father had a partner named Bernie. Bernie was about 20 years younger than my father. He was a clothes horse, which I really thought was great. He lived in some place called the Five Towns, which I had no idea what that meant, but I thought it meant everybody was rich. And he also was I also thought he married for money, which I thought was a genius idea in those days. And I told him, but more than anything else, Bernie used to throw his coffee away about 11:30 in the morning, crack a tray of cubes, and pour himself a big thing of vodka, and I thought to myself, I want to be just like Bernie. So I figured I'd come to New York, become a sophisticated drinker. The sophistication part eluded me by a long ways. Although I did meet my first ex-wife. You know the plaintiff? She was perfect for a guy like me. I mean, she was beautiful. She was lustful. She was home alone. Her parents were in Florida for the winter. But she got into my friend's car, sat on my lap, and this was the clincher. She whispered in my ear, don't believe anything anybody tells you about me. Overblown ego, no self-esteem, future alcoholic, it's a knee-jerk reaction. I'm like married already. By the time her parents come home, I'm like in. And, you know, nothing ever worked. You know, that's how we are. You know, we go from one sick thing to the next. And so what happens to me, I'm 26 years old. I'm just about ready to pack it in with this episode of my life. And the truth of the matter is I come down with testicular cancer. It's 37 years ago when I heard a speaker tell my story and say, you know, cancer was a snap compared to alcoholism. And the reason for it, for him and me, I was so toxic in those days, cancer couldn't live in my body. I mean, I couldn't go to Sloan Kettering Hospital like a normal cancer patient because I'm a Woodstock guy. I mean, I drank like a fish, but I also had the shoebox with all the accoutrements. So I can't go in there because you guys don't have enough pain medicine and sleeping stuff for a guy like me, so I bring the accoutrements. And as a matter of fact, the only time you ever heard me say, no thanks, I've had enough, I'm overdosing in my own hospital bed, in Sloan Kettering Hospital. When the nurse comes in at 9:45 with one little pill and a little Dixie cup, and I'm actually leaning back and going, no thanks, I've had enough. And that's who I am. And, you know, it just war stories go on forever. I love it. And the bottom line is that I ran hot and heavy with my kid brother Jeff all these years. And what happened to me is that Jeff moved into the city. But it wasn't a nice neighborhood. It was right around the Times Square area. And it was that time in New York where it was before they cleaned up New York, where all the dirty old man bars had that used booze, urine, stink, and we loved it. And we were doing a lot of despicable things together and on our own. And what happened to me is about 12 years ago, give or take, it's about 14, 15 years ago, I went to this bar for our morning drink, right near the Port Authority, and I saw my brother for what he had become. Jeff had purple circles under his eyes. He was emaciated. He was jaundiced. He was losing his teeth. He was a shell of a human being, and I really got scared. And I thought as a defensive thing, as a brother, that maybe we should go our own separate ways. So he went his way, I went my way. I continued to do all the geographics and all the isms that manifest us to get into AA. I reinvented myself so many times. I got divorced. I met my current wife, Connie. She met a figment of my imagination. And I became a dry cleaner. I got out of the garment center, moved to Long Island. There was a druggist on one side of the store. There was a bar on the other side of the store, and this was the perfect equation for me. Cash and everything else that went with it. And so what happened to me succinctly is this. I got bad. I got worse. I had no idea what my problem really was. And somewhere around 12 years ago, my wife was in having a procedure done in North Shore Hospital, which was about a half-hour drive from where I was living at the time. And I was going to be at bottom. I didn't know what that would be, but I was toxic to the max, and I was even scaring myself. And right before I was going to get in the car and actually drive there, my mother called and told me that my brother had gotten sober in another fellowship, and now he's in AA. I had no idea what that meant. But he'd like to come to the hospital and visit my wife and myself. Would that be okay? I said, okay. And somehow I got there, and I sat there thinking I'm visiting, but of course I'm rocking and nodding and all that kind of stuff. And all of a sudden the door opened, and what happened to me is what happened to Bill Wilson when he saw his friend Ebbie Thatcher. My brother looked fresh as a daisy. His eyes were clear, his cheeks were rosy. He looked great. I hadn't seen my brother look like this since we were little boys when my dad used to take us out to West End 2 at Jones Beach and play in the sand as two spiritually charged little boys before all this just caved in on us. And so, you know, in short, you know, my wife got out of the hospital. She's okay today. I don't know really what happened, but I assume my brother and my wife had that interventional conversation because she bore down to me when she got home and told me, if you don't do something about yourself, you're out of here. And all I heard was an old Kenny Rogers song about the gambler and running out of aces and knowing when to fold them. And the bottom line is, I had never, ever, ever tried to cut down, back off, whatever it was. I mean, you know, Tito may have not been not home that night, or Sundays we couldn't get to a liquor store in those days. But there was no way I was trying to do this on my own. But it was a rainy, drizzly night, and I just slumped into my first meeting and fell in knowing what I was going to experience. And all I heard that night, although they said everything that night that we say every night in an AA meeting, all I heard was make 90 meetings in 90 days. And I thought whatever that was supposed to mean, I guess by that time I would detox or whatever it was, and then I can, you know, get the heck out of here. I did hear them say, find somebody who like what they have. I'm thinking burglary. I love burglary, so they told me, you want to steal what we have, be my guest, you know. And I loved the stories. I mean, there was something about every night. I hated the meetings, but I stayed every night. I loved the stories. Some old white-haired guy with one tooth who came into AA off the Bowery and came 32 years later, you know, he's a doctor on 61st and Park. You know, I started to connect the dots. You know, I don't know if I'm an alcoholic, but I'll tell you, I know I'm not an idiot. And I started to think, is it possible? Does AA really work? And, you know, they sent me over there for coffee and cookies and Friday night ice cream and orange juice and told me to go to the doctor. And I finally get to a doctor, and he checks my sugar level and head ricochets, and he's asking me what I'm eating, and I tell him. He goes, you know, you're hypoglycemic. And, you know, you almost died trying to get sober at the Farmingdale group, wherever the hell you are. And, you know, and that's what it was. You know, I ended up the next day at the Jones Beach Sunrise Group, which is where I got sober the first time. I was surrounded by old-timers. That's all I knew. There was something that made me fall in love with AA. It was really love at first sight, and I just loved coming. I even stopped drinking and doing the other stuff. I didn't know that when I got here because I didn't think I needed a sponsor. I believed that having this cool, cavalier attitude about my relationship with alcohol and all the other self-destructible, what AA was going to be for me. I mean, I owned a dry cleaner, right? I told people, you want to roll a split and smoke it back by the exhaust fan so you don't bother the customers the way I used to. It's okay, I'm an AA, it doesn't bother me. I mean, I had an old woman with a British accent who once told me years and years ago, you know, if you're really into this, you really got to get serious because, you know, Orthodox Jews do not keep sides of pork and Swiss cheese in the house in case Gentile friends show up to offer it to them. And non-smokers do not keep cartons of cigarettes in the house, you know, in ashtrays, just in case your smoking friends show up. And, you know, I've been with Vince at a lot of places, and I've never come in, and people put piles of cocaine and heroin on the table with tourniquets and syringes and say, I don't shoot up, but maybe you guys would like to. So, you know, I knew what she meant. I really got serious. I started to really love what I was doing. You know, but what happens to a guy who runs off with the nickname Fellow Shit from not doing the program, you know, that voice came back into my head and told me, you're not alcoholic. And 72 hours later, I can't begin to tell you what it was, but now I had picked up, I'm sitting in the house, I got the jug between my legs, and all those accoutrements are back, and I don't know what to do. You know, I'm actually like the guy in the book who's pounding on the bar screaming, I don't know how this happened. I'm not having fun. I'm just feeding the beast. I hadn't had fun in over 25 years, and I didn't know what to do. But I did have the one phone number from the illusionary sponsor guy who I never called. And I called him, and he told me to walk to his office, and I did. And I sat down, and he got up to be a little dramatic, and he said to me, "Alan, if you are as hopeless as you seem to be, all recovery really starts now. But not the way you've been living, hip, slick, and quick, trying to get all the shortcuts together, because AA came into being during the Depression when commitment meant for life. And I seemed to know what he meant. Because at that point, I seem to have been having a moment of clarity when I realized for the very first time that I was the guy in the doctor's opinion. And that I was the guy that obsessed about drinking and all the other replacements to drinking. And whenever I put that stuff to my lips, the phenomenon of craving kicked in. I was alcoholic. And that if I wanted to do something about it, I'd have to draw a line in the sand, say never again, and do what all of you people have done to achieve long-term contented sobriety. So I went home, I told the wife I did it again, I called my brother, and I told him I felt possessed, that I want an exorcist. And you know, all old-timers, even at 4 years, they give you the wink. He had an AA exorcist for me. And he sent me down to this guy. He told me, "Don't screw this up. If you say you're going to go, go." And I went down there totally willing to do whatever that guy told me to do. And I thought I was being interviewed. I was really taking a third step. He whipped out tear sheets and whatnot. And, you know, I just followed the leader. And I've been doing that ever since. And, you know, it's not like I had this white light experience, but I did feel for the very first time that I was off the bench, that I'm no longer a sub, and that I'm in AA, and I'm on the first team. And quite frankly, I've been doing the things that my sponsors have been telling me to do from that day till this, mostly because I'm in love with AA, and secondly, because I'm terrified not to. So I wake up, I have quiet time in the morning, I call my sponsor, I kiss the wife goodbye, I tell her I love her, she tells me she loves me more. I clean out the litter box, I walk the dogs, I try and make amends to being that lazy person who used to leave the house. You know, now it looks like, hopefully, like my wife lives alone when I leave. And all I could tell you is that I love service. I know service keeps you sober. I'm an active member in AA from the second I wake up till the second I go to sleep. And, you know, I'm a loving husband. I'm a, you know, very devoted brother. I'm a good employee. Things that I really didn't know or really care about are now the most cherished parts of what it means to be sober. It's been a great run. You know, I came in at 48 years old. I'm a member of No Frills in Levittown. I came to that group on my second day after Jeff. I heard, you know, we meet at 5 o'clock every day. I know everybody refers to the Atlanta group as an enthusiastic bunch, but my place has stark raving sobriety. We do service at all the local institutions, and so the newbies come out of the institutions where we do service, and they show up every day, because 5 o'clock is before the night meetings, and so we believe in sponsorship and service, and we may not be going to Woodstock, but we're going to Eisenhower Park. And we'll all be at the Jones Beach Sunrise Group breakfast. And, you know, it's a lot of fun. I have a lot of friends. I know a lot of people come here and speak from L.A. I also have those kind of friends, but they're from a town that they refer to as Lower Akron. And I love Akron. Part of my service is being on a trustee at Dr. Bob's house. It is our Bethlehem. And if you've never been there, why don't you just let this be a seed and think about it for the future? And in short, you know, It's been a great run. Before it got too late in my family's existence. My sobriety date is May 13th. I guess I left that out. But the bottom line is it's completely linked with Mother's Day. And years ago, before my mother got ill and passed on, I was able to ask my mother, you know, what would you like to do? We're coming up on Mother's Day. You know, Jeff's alone. Do you want to come into the city, spend the day with him? We'll understand. Or you want to come out to Amityville and spend the day with Connie and I? And my mother told me, Mother's Day is every day because my boys are sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if it wasn't for groups like this and friends like ours, I don't know where I'd be. I thank you for my life.